Welcome to the Cloud Computing Show, episode number 23. My name is Gary Ornstein, host of the show, and I'm really happy today to have a guest all the way from London, Bernard Dallet from Index Ventures. Hi, Bernard. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Gary. Pleased to be here.
Great. So let's start with the industry news. We're really, this is the first show of 2010, so we're just going to cover the news that's happened. I guess it's really just this week. And, you know, two stories. One that was came out early in the week was the news about VMware buying Zimbra. And I've seen some people who call it a rumor. Some people say it's a done deal. I'm not exactly sure. But what did you make of this deal, Bernard?
You know, I think two questions, right? I mean, the first one is, would Yahoo sell? Why would it make sense for Yahoo to sell? I think seems to be, to me, quite obvious that they would actually sell. Zimbra is more of an enterprise-focused business than a consumer one. And given Yahoo's current focus, it doesn't look like Zimbra is a good fit in their portfolio. Hence, divesting it seems logical. And the question is, you know, does it make sense for VMware? You know, would they actually buy it? Even though it's not the first name that would have come to mind, when you think a little bit more about it, it does actually seem quite credible for a couple of reasons. The first one, obviously, is that Paul Maritz certainly understands this business. And the second is, you know, VMware has actually shown with the acquisition of SpringSource that it was entering a more aggressive phase in its business development. Mm-hmm. In the past couple of years, VMware's acquisitions had primarily been tack-on deals to augment the capabilities of its virtualization management platform.
Right.
They bought one of our companies as well, Beehive. But Spring has been a much bolder step, primarily to marry the Java community.
Right, and the development community. I mean, the way I understood part of that deal is that they are trying to move upstream in the development process so that when, as you mentioned, a Java developer is deciding what kind of cloud computing infrastructure to rely on, they're going to favor VMware because of a tight integration.
Exactly. I mean, embrace them, integrate deeply with them, and you know, you're sort of in pole position when deciding, you know, on Microsoft versus Citrix versus VMware.
Right.
And the question is, you know, what comes next? And, you know, this vCloud initiative that VMware has, whereby they're going to allow service providers to essentially deploy and run cloud services and compete with Amazon. You know, I think that's actually going to be a pretty important initiative when truly launched. I mean, at this stage, they've only launched this vCloud Express thing, which is not, you know, the real deal. But when in 2010, they really launched vCloud, you know, the service provider market is really ripe for an offering, allowing them to jump on the cloud services bandwagon.
So your take is that this Zimbra offering will get a lot of traction through the VMware resellers.
That's, you know, that would be my take. I mean, it feels like if you're going to go to all these service providers and offer them this platform based on VMware infrastructure for them to offer a cloud platform, cloud services, you know, it would be great in terms of, you know, differentiation to be able to offer other stuff as well. And, you know, we know from the Comcast deal, right, that Zimbra did, that Zimbra is quite a good platform for service providers. I mean, it's highly scalable. It's easy to manage, and that's why, you know, they had success with service providers in the past. So it would seem to be quite a good fit in sort of in the VMware's portfolio once they truly get going with vCloud.
Yeah, I think it's good news for everybody. Particularly, I am a little bit afraid that there aren't enough choices for viable, what I'll call modern day email platforms, because Gmail appears to be the only one that is really embracing integration with web applications and so forth. And Zimbra sort of got, I think, a little bit left behind, maybe because of the mix-up of what business Yahoo actually thought they were in. So, you know, you've got Microsoft with the base of Outlook continuing forward, but there really needs to be some more modern-day competition there, and I think it's great that VMware is going to put some emphasis behind Zimbra. Zimbra, I think, might be the best platform of them all, but really hasn't been given a fair stage, so to speak, to reach their full potential.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think, you know, I think it's still a pretty good platform, but clearly you know, was not in the right hands in the past sort of 18 months or so.
Yeah, and when you look at the amount of integration with all the little web widgets and things that they've been able to do, it's really amazing.
Yeah, it's it is a good platform. Before the Yahoo acquisition, it was ramping very, very quickly. Probably still has done quite well, you know, while being owned by Yahoo. But it is not a sort of a consumer facing application per se. I mean, it is more for SMEs and bigger businesses, and potentially as a platform for service providers to provide emails to their business customers.
Yeah. Well, that's an interesting take on it. So we'll see what happens with that. You know, the other big story this week, and I got flamed a little bit last night on Twitter when I was mentioning what stories to talk about, but I said, should we discuss the cloud computing impact of Nexus One? And one of my friends said, oh, goodness, don't talk about Nexus One any more than we have to. But I think it's significant from a cloud computing perspective that we have one of the biggest companies pursuing cloud computing on all fronts, consumer-focused, business-focused, marrying to a tightly integrated mobile device. What's your take? Not on the phone specifically, but sort of what this means for cloud computing in general.
Yeah, you know, I think, you know, we don't really need more proof that mobile internet has come of age, right? I mean, the explosion of the iPhone made it very clear to all of us. And recently, actually, you know, the acquisitions in quick succession of AdMob and Quattro by Google and Apple, you know, underlines, you know, who some of the biggest protagonists are in sort of enabling the mobile internet,
right?
Which now goes from the smartphone to the tablet, Kindle to netbooks, etc. It's all over the place. And essentially, what I think has happened over the past year or two is that the Western world has also gone mobile. If you want, you know, we used to talk about China and Korea and as being at the forefront of mobile internet, and I think we've now joined the bandwagon. If you think about, you know, being in Google's shoes or in Apple's shoes, you know, Google particularly, you know, they have a very juicy search business and a growing display business as well. And, you know, they launched this Android platform. But being in the operating system and platform on mobile is one thing. But, you know, it may not be enough when you're facing a juggernaut like Apple. You know, there's nothing like really controlling the form factor that to ensure that, you know, rich application ecosystem is gonna emerge, and that's key to wide adoption. So, I think if you're in Google shoes, it would make sense that, you know, beyond all of the efforts that they've already done to promote sort of the mobile internet, that they would try to get into sort of a more control of the form factor to ensure that, you know, the iPhone doesn't just run away.
Right.
You know, I think the outcome of that is just like the race to sort of a mobile internet is accelerating, and, you know, we're all going to be using more and more of internet services on a mobile basis. And it feels like, you know, once we are all kind of using internet while on the go, we will really feel the need, the desire to have more and more of our data residing in the cloud. So I see that as a, you know, further sort of impetus to help overcome some of the concerns around sort of confidentiality that sort of slows a little bit the cloud adoption.
Uh-huh.
You know, I think consumers are going to be used to having data residing in the cloud, and that's going to push more of us to becoming an adopter of the cloud,
right,
on a consumer basis as well as on a business basis.
Right. There were some stories yesterday about how the Nexus One was only making a very small amount of memory. I think it was on the order of 200 megabytes available for applications. And the counterpoint was, yeah, but, you know, really this is geared to be a cloud computing device, not a standalone client. And, you know,
yeah,
a side topic here that I'm curious to get your perspective on, somewhat related to this story, is, you know, in the world of our laptops, we seem to be moving away from installing client applications and having everything go through the browser. Of course, on that front, Google is pushing Chrome as the end-all, be-all to the desktop or laptop computing experience. Yet, if you look at what Apple's done with the iPhone, it's quite the opposite of that, with downloading, you know, apps to your heart's content. you know, we'll see. Android might be some middle ground. They'll certainly have to have a big focus on the application store just to compete with the iPhone. But personally, I don't really want to download applications. What's your take on this, you know, change from the desktop experience focused on the browser to the mobile experience focused on downloading apps?
Yeah, it feels like, you know, you do both, right? I mean, with your mobile phone, I guess. And I think it's a question of the form factor. It's still not as easy, right, to use a sort of a purely browser-based application on a mobile phone that it is on a PC. And I think that's just the nature of that. To make applications more usable, you know, sort of downloading an app is sort of a pain that probably a lot of people are ready to go through, you know, just to have access to services on a more user-friendly basis. And so I think it's going to continue being sort of a hybrid model where, you know, we're going to use some apps directly from the browser and we're going to continue using a bunch of apps that we have downloaded.
Right. Well, I'm pushing for more from the browser. Maybe HTML5 on the mobile phones will make pull the pendulum back to more browser. That's just my personal preference.
Yeah.
Great. Well, I think that's a wrap-up for major stories in the news. Let's jump into specific questions for you and some activities around Index Ventures. Before we get into that, maybe you could fill us in a little bit about on your background and how you got to Index Ventures.
Sure. So I'm an electrical engineer. I graduated from the Swiss Institute of Technology, and I started my career with Procter & Gamble in their IT department as a systems analyst, and then became a project manager, rolled out some pretty large and complex ERP implementations for P&G, SAP, one of them. And after 4 years, I did my MBA at Kellogg, worked for McKinsey for a while, and I just hooked up with some of the founders of Index towards the end of 98 and joined the firm at that point as an associate and grew through the ranks. You know, I started as pretty much as a generalist covering all sectors, and then focused as time went on, I focused more and more on software and enterprise applications.
Mm-hmm. So tell us a little bit about your focus areas and some of the current investments that you're most active in. And, you know, in case people don't know about, you know, some of the companies, maybe just fill in a little detail about what each is doing.
Yeah, so I focus mostly on software and enterprise companies. So some of the companies that I'm currently on a board of, there's a few open source companies, including DimDim, which is sort of a web conferencing player, sort of the open source WebEx killer, if you want. There's Pentaho, which is an open source business intelligence company. OpenX, which is an open source ad platform, started as an ad server and has become a more all-encompassing online ad platform. Then there's a couple of more sort of traditional enterprise software companies. One is called Optier. It's an Israeli company in the performance management space, selling sort of solution to big enterprise in different sectors such as financials and healthcare. I'm on the board of a stealth cloud company called StorSimple, which is, as its name indicates, is in the storage space, so cloud storage space. And then in a few other companies that are neither open source nor cloud related.
Right. Great. Well, that's a great. I have to say, I am a big fan of DimDim. So thank you for helping them along the way.
I've
used it extensively. The response has been great. And people who I share it with have also been very attracted to it. Of course, I am I have a real hot button for these heavyweight web conferencing tools that want to take over your entire machine and control every process on it. And alternatives like DimDim are a real savior for me. So
glad to hear that.
Yeah. And in fact, they were one of my cloud tip picks early on in the show. So maybe we can get an introduction. We'll have them on the show at some point in the future.
Yeah, definitely.
So in preparing for this show, you had shared a couple of really big themes around software and around cloud computing that you've been formulating, I think probably in part for investment strategies and watching the market. And one of the big themes that you had is that software as a service is making open source irrelevant, which is a very provocative statement. Why don't I stop here and let you put a little bit of that to the audience in your own words?
Yeah, I think what I was trying to say by that is open source these days is almost all about SaaS, essentially, software as a service. So, as a firm at Index, we continue to be big believers in open source. We had two open source exits in Trolltech and MySQL. We have a very healthy open source portfolio, including DimDim, OpenX, Zend, Lustre, which is a storage platform, and Pentaho that I mentioned. But the companies that we are focusing on going forward, and the trend that we see in our portfolio as well, is companies that are marrying open source and SaaS. The advantages of open source are well known, right? It's a great way of developing and distributing software. It also addresses customers, and there are still a lot of them today, still that want an on-premise solution and don't want to access a solution in the cloud. And also on the sales front, it helps companies build a sales funnel and build visibility. But the drawbacks of a pure open source on-premise solution is that, unless you're a Red Hat, it's not the easiest model to monetize because there's always competition between all of the value that you're providing for free and sort of the community edition and, and what you're trying to build on top to monetize the service, beyond just providing support. And SaaS, luckily, is not only convenient for users, but it provides just a natural monetization channel for these open source companies.
Right. Right. If you think about if it's open source software, you could do it yourself. There's no, you're not really thinking about writing a check.
You're not, right? I mean, it's natural to write a check if you're using a service. And even on a sort of a SaaS basis, you can decide to use a freemium model where or a try before you buy model. But it's a more natural relationship, right? Once you're using a service to write a check for it, it feels more natural than when you can download this stuff and, and 90% of the functionality is already available for free to you.
Right. So do you think that the attention open source has received is now a little bit unfounded, or is it more a matter of changing priorities or the value of what open source brings to the table?
Yeah, I don't think it's unfounded. I continue to think it's a great way. I mean, it's the way to develop software. I mean, you have a community that's engaged, that is making suggestions in terms of improvements, that is reporting bugs, that is sometimes making contributions. And so, all the buzz that you create around it, it's just the end result of that is just better software than if you, sort of lock yourself in your room and just write software and then at one point just come up with it and tell people to use it. I mean, open source just makes more sense. But software as a service or cloud, I think, is an opportunity for these companies to build hybrid models that are easier to monetize. And we've seen it in our portfolio with companies like DimDim and OpenX, which started purely as on-premise open source solutions. So you download it, install it on your server and start using it. And then, we had different ways of building a business on top of it, offering support or some other modules that came on top of it. But as soon as we launched the SaaS offering, that portion of the revenues became significant very, very quickly.
Yeah, I think that psychology of what your expectations are in the classic definition of open source software versus service is so important that and it's only now really becoming recognized in terms of, as you say, how do you drive revenues? It'd be great if we could all just do the technology development, but if we can't get folks to pay for it, it doesn't go very far.
Yeah, I mean, the term commercial open source came up, which is essentially, it's not an open source project, it's an open source company. There's a venture firm behind it, so there is an attempt at building a business. The question is, how do you do it on the back of software that you sort of give away for free to a large extent?
Right.
Well, you build great software using the open source model. and then you deliver it as a service for those customers that are comfortable or that desire to use it as a service. And then, you know, you just build a subscription model on top of it. That's just a natural way of building a business. So when we look at open source companies, typically these days, that's what we look at. We look at the ability to marry, you know, open source with a sort of a software as a service subscription based model.
Right. So there's been some discussion on the blogs recently about, you know, who does open source benefit most? Does it benefit the developer or the vendor more? Does it benefit the customer more? What's your take on the trade-offs there?
I haven't followed these blog discussions. I'm actually surprised to hear that, because, you know, being on the board of a couple of these open source companies and seeing the vast usage of the product compared to, you know, the percentage of customers that actually end up paying for the product, it feels like, you know, the user community benefits a lot, you know, from open source. And I see it in my portfolio as well. There's a lot of our companies that are using a bunch of open source solutions without, you know, paying a penny or paying a dime. It's kind of hard to make an argument that users don't benefit greatly from open source.
Yeah.
You know, I think hopefully it's a win-win situation where, you know, both benefits, and the vendors have a more sort of cost-effective business model because they're, you know, they're able to generate more awareness for their product and to build better software solutions, while at the same time finding a way to charge for it, which, as I said, and before, SaaS was a little bit of a conundrum. I mean, it was never very easy, and I think now it's become much more natural.
Right, right. Yeah, I think it probably there is, you know, it is benefiting both sides, and certainly anytime there's an exchange between vendor and customer, you know, putting either party in a better position is going to help both sides. So, you know, just a different angle on the discussion there. We have another big theme, but before I do that, I wanted to just take a slight detour and talk about OpenX, because as you mentioned earlier on, there's been such a wave of activity recently with advertising platforms and the Google AdMob activity and the Quantcast activity. Give us a little take on what you see happening, you know, in that market in 2010, and maybe, you know, some things that are specific to OpenX, if you can share them.
Well, you know, what we expect is going to happen in 2010 is, you know, online advertising, broadly speaking, is going to start getting back on the path of growth, where, you know, 2009 was, generally speaking, a tough year, even for online advertising. So, you know, we've seen already in Q4, you know, very pretty strong trends of recovery in online advertising in our portfolio. You know, we have different companies playing in this space. You know, in terms of OpenX specifically, the company has continued to grow very quickly. You know, there is about 50,000 publishers using the online ad platform today to power their websites and to manage the advertising of their websites. And it's growing quickly. And OpenX has developed a portfolio of services ranging from sort of the pure ad server to a marketplace, for example, enabling advertisers to bid directly for inventory that they think is valuable for them, and allowing the publishers to essentially float that inventory on the marketplace. So it's going in the direction of real-time bidding, which hopefully sort of increases the average revenue per impression that publishers get. So what OpenX is trying to do is to offer an independent advertising platform which keeps the publishers fully in control of their data. I think Google, obviously, you know, is coming from a different angle. They are merging their, you know, the DoubleClick acquisition that they've done with the rest of their properties. And, you know, using Google, you're obviously kind of they have a pretty good visibility of all of your data. And the question that publishers ask themselves is, are they getting, you know, sort of the maximum revenues for their ad impression? So OpenX is offering an alternative to Google, where not only is it easier to kind of customize a little bit some of the functions of the ad platform, but, you know, publishers stay in full control of their data. can use that to essentially maximize the revenues that they generate from their ad inventory.
Very interesting. Great. Well, one of the other big themes that you'd mentioned prior to us getting together is something called the double cloud, which is you do a great job with these catching headlines. I think I'm going to have to call you, for some of my blog post headlines in the future. But tell us a little bit about what you mean by the double cloud.
Yeah, it's the double cloud or the multiple cloud is essentially, the rising prevalence of the cloud in all of the startups that we look at. In the early 2000s, we suddenly saw many startups in our deal flow dropping Oracle for MySQL, dropping Solaris for Linux. They were suddenly adopting open source en masse, And then there came a wave of companies themselves using open source as a business model. And then when we observed that is essentially when we started building our open source portfolio in kind of the 2002 timeframe. The same thing is happening now with the cloud. Suddenly we see all of these startups coming that have no infrastructure anymore. At least to start with, they are leveraging infrastructure in the cloud. At the moment, it's predominantly Amazon. We talk about the cloud and pretty much 90% of the startups we see, it's AWS. And they're sometimes offering just a software as a service solution, and sometimes they're offering themselves cloud services. So you see companies that are offering cloud services that themselves are running on the cloud. And, the first one of these infrastructure-less companies that we invested in was Playfish, which is a social gaming company recently acquired by Electronic Arts.
Yep.
I think that was in 2008. And in 2009, we saw massive adoption of AWS in our portfolio. So companies like OpenX, Bentaho, looking through the lenses of what we see at RightScale, you can see the AWS adoption and in our deal flow as well. I mean, suddenly we had all these companies coming, and the only infrastructure that they had was on the cloud running at Amazon.
Yeah, I mean, this has got to be a huge accelerator for venture financing in that it drastically reduces the capital needed for a particular investment.
Yeah, I think that's a good question.
Oh, maybe it doesn't.
No, yeah, I mean, I'm asking myself the question because to get a business, to get to kickstart something, no question about it. But for example, DimDim doesn't use Amazon, right? And they made a cost analysis, and for them, given the traffic, the volume of traffic that they see, for them, it's much more cost effective to be kind of running their own cloud. So they have their own infrastructure at a colo data center. And, the Amazon bill would be much too high. And we're starting to see some pretty hefty AWS bill in some of our portfolio companies as well. So I don't know about in the long term how, cost effective. I think what's probably going to happen is the prices of cloud services and Amazon and other competitors are going to come down quite drastically. Mm-hmm. And that's going to put things back in balance. But it's not, I don't think it's a matter of, at the moment, it's not a matter of like great cost effectiveness in the long run.
Right.
I think it's in the short term. It's very cost effective to get something off the ground. Then you have to ask yourself the question when, you start hitting a certain volume, which is why also, I guess the ability to move from one cloud, to another, not to avoid vendor lock-in, is quite important, or is going to become quite important going forward.
Yeah, you hear this story a lot that people grow out of Amazon because the bill gets too high, and I really don't think that that's yet reached its end state. It doesn't make sense to me why, from a pricing perspective, Amazon can't offer something more cost-effective than an individual customer would be able to get on their own. At the same time, I think there's a natural inclination that's a financial inclination for businesses. Once an operating expense, a recurring operating expense gets too high, there's a natural desire to convert that into a capital expense and finance it, which, you know, it's more of an accounting a momentum than a technology decision. But I don't think we've seen the end of this balance about, you know, when do I grow out of AWS, or, you know, when does the bandwidth bill better dealt with externally than through an Amazon channel?
Yeah, I agree with you. I think prices are going to come down. You know, if you look, for example, S3, if you look at storage prices, you know, if you look at the prices of serial ATA drives, for example, and how that has collapsed over the past 12 months, that trend hasn't been reflected in sort of storage service prices. So I think there's a lot of room there to move prices down when they need to. So right. I would expect the prices are going to come down. And, you know, as you said, I mean, the economies of scale that Amazon and I guess even Rackspace and Microsoft can achieve are significant, and at some point that's going to filter down to the users and customers.
Right. Yeah. Personally, I'm predicting that there needs to be much more innovation, and there will be more innovation to cut bandwidth expenses than to cut static storage capacity, terabytes expenses.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think there's a lot of challenges, right, in sort of moving data back and forth. So whatever you can do, you know, to sort of limit the impact of bandwidth usage, I think is going to be very welcome to sort of manage the bills.
Yeah. So whether that's a CDN Akamai related innovation or a WAN optimization innovation or something that we haven't yet thought of, I'm predicting that cutting bandwidth costs is going to drive, you know, more innovation than some of these new, you know, I can store it for a penny cheaper per gigabyte.
Yeah.
Great. Well, give us some insight if you can in your 2010 outlook about, you know, you've some of the areas of cloud computing specifically that you're keeping an eye on. If you can share any cool companies or sectors that you're watching with the audience, that'd be great. And just tell us a little bit about your outlook for the year.
Yeah. So, as I said, I think the year ended on a pretty good recovery. I think, you know, Q3, Q4 started being stronger across the board in our companies when the first half of the year was very tough. So it looks like now we're sort of on an upswing. You've probably seen that with all of the kind of deal activity in the valley. I think we can expect, when you look at all the, you know, the mountains of cash that the big companies have, and the kind of a tectonic plate shifting movements that are going around in the industry, you can expect quite a fair number of M&A activities that is further going to sort of accelerate recovery on the venture side. So I think we're set for a pretty good year in 2010 on the venture side and in tech in general. On our side, you know, we've been pretty busy. We're actually we're in the process of closing two new cloud or SaaS investments in the next 30 days, which, you know, we'll be announcing shortly when they close. One being one of these hybrid models that I talked about, which is a mix of open source and cloud, and the other one being a more sort of traditional software as a service business. We've been busy and quite optimistic in terms of, you know, the outlook for 2010. Just to answer your questions about, you know, some cool companies, you know, I've seen recently, there are a couple of companies that come to mind, but, you know, one that I think is very interesting that I came across, you know, we're not an investor in it, but is a company called Soasta. I don't know if you're familiar with them.
A little bit, yes.
Yeah, Soasta, which I think is a cool company when you think about how successful Mercury Interactive was, right, in the testing space in the early 2000s, and the fact that test is one of the first places where enterprises are comfortable leveraging the cloud, right, because it's not mission critical, it's not a production application. And so what these guys are offering is a cloud service for testing purposes. So it does functional testing, it does load testing, it runs on the cloud, and actually it runs on Amazon. So it's one example of these infrastructure-less companies which leverages AWS to offer a cloud service themselves, which is leveraged by enterprises to test their web applications and scalability and functional.
Yeah, I think that test and development area is such a sweet spot for cloud activity. It's really that of all the things that there are, that one has got to be one of the biggest no-brainers of the bunch.
Yeah, so you know that's an example of the tech companies that that would be looking to back in 2010.
Excellent. Great. Well, let's move on to the next section of our show. We call it Cloud Tips, where we try to share a consumer or business-facing cloud service or company or application or tool. You've already mentioned many, but we try to get one that maybe isn't in the portfolio or something. So I'll go first. My pick for this week is a very consumer-focused one. It's called Posterous. And Posterous is, I guess you could call it a little bit of a microblog, but the beauty of Posterous is that it allows – are you familiar with Posterous, Bernard?
No, I'm not.
So it allows you to link to all of your social networking sites, your Twitter, Facebook, Flickr, YouTube, Blogger, whatever you've got. And then everything is done via email. So you want to post a picture to just the Posterous thing, you can send it to posterous@posterous.com. It recognizes your email, so there's nothing else involved. And up the picture or the video or the blog post, whatever, goes right up there. Now, if you wanted to do something to Twitter and Facebook, you could send the picture via email to Twitter+Facebook@posterous.com, and it would go to Twitter and Facebook. If you wanted to send something just to your blog account, you would do blogger@posterous.com. So it gives you a whole variety of mechanisms to manage your various social media from one central point. Super convenient. I just started using it, but I've become a big fan. So Posterous is my pick. We'll put a link in the show notes. Bernard, did you have another pick besides a number of the things that you'd already shared with us?
Yeah, I'll share one more. It's actually more for developers than it is for consumers.
Good. We'll have a balance.
But it is a company called Twilio, T-W-I-L-I-O, which actually just, I think, on the end of December 30th, they announced their Series A funding by Union Square Ventures. Mm-hmm. It's an interesting company. It is essentially, it allows to build voice applications using very simple API, sort of AWS type API, that, you know, so you can build all sorts of voice-based applications, such as an IVR, or you can build sort of a customer-facing type polling applications, speech to text, etc., and essentially directly integrate that into web development code in a very simple way.
I am familiar with Twilio. Jeff Lawson, the CEO, was a guest on the show half a dozen shows ago.
And all right,
it is a very cool service.
Very cool, and again, it's one that I think runs on AWS.
So yeah. So my question to you, Bernard, is: have you changed the Index Ventures voice, PBX to Twilio yet?
Not yet. We need to have a developer in house to do it.
You know, I'm not sure. I my guess is that you're capable of doing HTML.
Probably, yeah.
And
I'm kidding. I think we should be able to do it.
Great recommendation. Thank you.
All right.
Well, that's a wrap up for today. I want to thank you, Bernard, for joining us. Really interesting to get the investor perspective on the whole cloud computing and software as a service industry. So I hope the listeners enjoyed it as well. Would you like to pass along contact details, URLs, Twitter activity, whatever is relevant for people to find out more about yourself or Index Ventures?
Yes, definitely. So my email, Bernard, B-E-R-N-A-R-D, at indexventures.com. And you can check our website, www.indexventures.com.
Great. And thanks again to our listeners. You can visit us at thecloudcomputingshow.com or email us at thecloudcomputingshow@gmail.com. And, of course, you can subscribe on iTunes via a link on our homepage or by just going to iTunes and searching for The Cloud Computing Show. Thanks again for joining us. We'll see everybody again next time.
Thanks a lot, Gary. Bye.
Thanks, Bernard.